Revelation chapter 8 is where we are, so let me give you a quick rundown as to where we've been, because some of you may not have been caught up with us so far. And also, we are recording these. They are on our webpage. You can go to the webpage. You can find both the class notes and the audio of the study. And so you can catch up that way, but let me give you the short version as we get into a different group of seven today. If you haven't been a participant in it so far, let me give you the very short summary. The revelation of Jesus Christ denotes that the author is Jesus, and the stenographer, the one who wrote it all down, was the Apostle John. The letters written to the seven churches in Asia Minor and what is now considered modern-day Western Turkey. The region was inundated at the time with Greco-Roman deity worship as well as emperor worship and Jewish influences which were hostile to Christianity. So there was a three-pronged persecution that was arising against the church. Believers in each of the seven churches to which the book was written were living as outsiders in their world. There was lots of pressure, lots of cultural pressure, even family pressures, to accommodate both religious and philosophical norms. They were told they needed to neglect their witness of Jesus because the persecution was growing. And there was just a lot of people around them, a lot like today, who were telling them that what they believed was nonsense. Even so, Jesus called these people to rise above the satanic influences which surrounded them and to remain, and this is key because I think this is one of the main themes of the whole book, to remain faithful witnesses even unto death. Did these believers have any motivation to remain faithful? Which is a great question that this book, I believe, answers. In many ways, this is what Revelation is all about. Jesus tells these people that being faithful witnesses unto death, which is a martyrdom term, by the way, that it would keep them close to their Lord, although he never tells them that they will be protected or rescued in their present existence from the evil influences that were surrounding them. There was instead, eschatological promises. Eschatological meaning? Thank you. The chorus is growing. That's good. End time promises if they remain faithful. And these promises were meant for their readers to experience as a reward for their faithfulness. So God's making promises to these people of things that are going to be theirs if they will remain faithful. It will be their reward for faithfulness. A theme of Revelation, and this is also key, a theme of Revelation is the reality of evil and suffering in the world. In no place does God take credit for inflicting suffering, nor does he apologize that evil and suffering exist. Evil and suffering are seen as present and a part of the worldly experience of the countercultural God life. So if you are living for God in the culture in which they are at, they are going to experience those who rise up against it, which by definition are evil and suffering. It may not always be present for them, but its existence is a byproduct of the ungodliness which is ramped up by God's enemy, Satan. Satan is going to be introduced quite directly in the chapters upcoming. So after being introduced to the seven churches, we're then taken into a vision given to John. The vision takes place in the throne room of God. The scene is full of magnificent angels and creatures, along with the representation of the entirety of those who belong to God. After a period of worship, a scroll of judgment is brought out that is, quote, sealed by seven seals. These seals of authority could not be opened by anyone, alive or dead, not even by the magnificent creatures that were worshiping around the throne. No matter how beautiful, incredible, powerful, impressive these creatures were, none of them could open these seals. And John laments, but there is The Lion of Judah, he is told, who can open the seals? And he turns and he looks and he sees a slaughtered lamb instead. And it's the lamb who opens the seals. And out comes all those things which are under God's authority. The seals represent conquest, famine, war, death, and terror. In Revelation 6, verses 9 through 11, we read about the fifth seal, which was opened by the slaughtered lamb. And in that paragraph, we read about martyrs who are under the altar. And I believe that these martyrs are key to understanding the rest of Revelation. These were under God's protection because of their faithfulness. And in this scene, the martyrs are praying for the Lord to intervene in the world and to avenge the blood of his saints. These martyrs are given white robes and they are told to rest. Don't worry about what's going to happen. Don't take it up in your mind that these things are coming. Okay? Revelation 7 gives us the sixth seal, which shows God's blessing and protection to all of his people, to all of Israel, which I believe the 144,000 represents, because, and they're even listed by tribe, and then to all other people, and all who come after Israel, and all of these people who are faithful unto death are promised white robes after they go through tribulation. We move away from the seven seals in Revelation 8, and we are introduced to another set of seven items. And yet these seven items are all related to the same thing we found when the fifth seal was opened, and that is the prayer of the saints. So here we go. And I know that there's a seventh seal. We're going to talk about that briefly in just a second. Revelation 8, though, beginning in verse 2. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. Another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar which was set before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, with the prayers of the saints, went up before God out of the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and threw it to the earth. And there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. Okay? At the end of Revelation chapter 7, we read an announcement of the coming of God's blessings for those who endure to the end. We read in 7:17 that the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd and will guide them to springs of the water of life, and God will wipe every tear from their eye. Okay? The beginning of chapter 8, we find there's an interlude of silence. How powerful is silence in the middle of a message that you're being given? And what does silence often denote? As a preacher, I use silence occasionally.
Importance.
All right. There is an importance.
To get your attention.
To get your attention. And also, transition. To make application. When you read the Psalms, as you read through the Psalms, there's often this little word that's kind of off to the side, or maybe it's Selah. Anybody know what Selah means? It kind of means pause. It's interlude, almost like intermission. And basically the idea is, you read this to this point, there's this huge effect that is meant to be felt. Selah. Silence. You take in what has been said so that you can get ready for what's about to be said. So the seventh seal, after all these things are shared, brings silence. And then there's a transition. The next scene are these seven angels who stand before God, and each of them are given seven trumpets. Silence is about to be broken. And it's these seven trumpets that will dominate the next section of the Revelation. Before the angels and their trumpets are given their marching orders, there is a scene change. The previous portion of the vision was the throne room, the sealed scroll of God's judgments, and the slaughtered lamb, the Lion of Judah, who not only had the authority to open the scrolls, but he also opened them. Okay? Now, after the judgments of God and the assurances that those who were numbered and sealed with God's seal of protection and hope would be safe, believe me, that's a lot of what the seals were. God has authority. Don't worry. You're going to be safe. Okay? After that, there is a new matter that has to be settled. Because the people who are at the altar, who were given the white robes and were told to rest, they ask a question. How long, God? How long before you answer the prayers of your faithful witnesses? How long are you going to let this go on? God had protected them and cleansed them and given them white robes and comforted them, but they're praying. So what about their prayers? The scene at the beginning of Revelation 8 has the angel of God being given a golden censer with much incense given to him. Okay? So, what was this incense? You have to go back and read through it a little bit, but what was the incense that he was given? It's described in the text. Much incense was given to him so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar. So what do you think the incense was? Okay. I think added to the prayers of all the martyred saints were the prayers of those who were still fighting the fight. The prayers of all the saints were being added to the prayers of those who were the faithful witnesses. And there was great power in those prayers. It was great power, such as fire. And there were answers sent to those prayers that also were filled with great power. Let's continue reading. Revelation chapter 8, beginning in verse 6. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. The first sounded, there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were struck, so that a third of them would be darkened, and the day would not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle flying in mid heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." I love the reaction over here. That's great. That's what it's supposed to do. That's exactly what the text is supposed to do. It's supposed to move within us and to bring these things out into the open so we are impressed with the power that's being generated from these words. Gregory Stevenson, in his book on Revelation, A Slaughtered Lamb, makes this observation. He says, and I quote, "The judgments of the first four trumpets encompass all the earth," 9 verse 7, The seas, 9, 8, and 9. The inland waters, 9, 10, and 11. And the celestial sphere, sun, moon, and stars, 9, 12. In short, these trumpets depict all of creation under God's sovereign control, though it is not God's creation itself that is the object of his judgment. All of creation is affected by these actions. In other words, not everybody's going to have to suffer this judgment, but everybody's going to have to live in the effect. Okay? The first four trumpets do not represent final end of time judgment by virtue of their limitation to one third of creation. That these judgments are limited in scope and under the authority of the sovereign Lord of all creation is an important part of the message of the trumpets. God's wrath comes in response to the prayers of the saints, but it is not wrath wantonly poured out and indiscriminate in the destruction it brings. It is wrath with a purpose that is an expression of God's sovereign plan for his creation. In other words, Gregory Stevenson's assertion here is that God here is in control, and his response to the saints is more specific and limited than it is indiscriminate. The earth is not wiped out, but the wrath poured out has a limited or measured effect. The sea is not so polluted by God that everything dies, but only a portion, both under and above the waters. The springs and other fresh waters are not made totally bitter, like wormwood, but only enough to meet God's limit of judgment. Not all the stars and the planets were destroyed, but only a portion of the sun and the moon were destroyed. So what does this limiting choice by God say about him? There's a really important thing I want to share with you, but go ahead. What do you think?
Maybe he has some restraint.
Maybe he has some restraint? That's good.
God has complete control.
He can do what
he can allow him to do what he wants in whatever measure he wants to dish out.
That's right. And in this case, he did a third of everything. A third of this, a third of this, a third of this, almost everything. All the grass was burned up and like that, but
maybe that's to try and wake the people up.
Well, maybe. Could very well be that he's trying to wake these people up. There's also one other thing, though, and that very well could be. But there's also one other thing that I observe, and it's my observation. I've just thought about this on my own. But I look at this, and I see God working, and I see him as being much more surgical than nuclear. You know, God has a tendency to get a bad rap sometime. You know, there's so much evil in the world. Why in the world do I have to put up with all the evil in the world? It's unfair that there's so much evil in the world. Where is God? Truth is, God is in control. We do have to face evil in the world. But just because we have to face evil in the world doesn't mean we have to face all evil. Doesn't mean there aren't things from which we are protected. Doesn't mean there aren't things which would overwhelm us if we were exposed to them. It just means that we're affected by it, but we're not overwhelmed. I believe that's what Paul had in mind when he talked about how we were beaten down but not crushed, perplexed but not despairing. He understood that the things that were ongoing in his life were things that were the result of the sinful world around him. But he was given the power and the ability to withstand it and to rise above it. And I believe that's the message that's trying to be communicated here. God is holy and God is sovereign. Wormwood is seen to refer to either an historic or futuristic being by many who interpret Revelation. In the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the word wormwood is used 7 times, always referring to horrible times of bitterness. The context of Revelation 8, verse 10, seems to refer to this use of the word. Here, wormwood, and I found this in, of all things, a Wikipedia article, but I thought it was so good I wanted to share it. Says, a number of Bible scholars consider the term wormwood to be a purely symbolic representation of the bitterness that will fill the earth during troubled times. Noting that the plant for which wormwood is named, Artemisia absinthium, I practiced that, also known as wormwood, is a known biblical metaphor for things that are unpalpably bitter. Okay? Therefore, I ask, why in the culture of these recipients would such bitterness be an instrument of God's righteous judgment? Why would God choose bitterness as a form of judgment? Okay, bitterness can be a challenge to faith that you need to go to God and help, for in His help. It drives you to a point where you go to the source of your strength. You can't rise above the bitterness. You go to the one who can help you. That's good. What else? Why use bitterness as an instrument of righteous judgment? Okay, why do you get food poisoning? You eat something that was ruined that your body will reject, right? And it also is a teaching moment that says never eat that again. That's the way me and fish have been all my life. As much as I've actually tried to eat fish. I know some people are saying, oh, well, you haven't tried X. Well, I have. Fish and I don't do well. So that's why I've tried to avoid fish. Now, I've tried some I've actually eaten that I thought were okay. I've tried catfish, of all things, and it really worked. Although I'm not really a big fan of catfish, I can eat it and not get sick. So that's a great, endorsement for catfish, you know. You like catfish? No, I can eat it and not get sick. But man, shrimp, you know, halibut.
What about oysters?
Definitely oyster. I can't almost think of oysters without getting sick. Go for it. You and your family be blessed. But my point is, God uses things that are bitter to drive people back to Him, to show people what life is like without Him, to show people what life is like when they reject His will. Bitterness is introduced, and it's meant to be an indicator that something you've ingested is causing you to be sick. Okay? The rejection of God's righteousness results in bitterness. Wormwood is also a metaphor, by the way, in the Old Testament of sadness. So, the result of God's rejection, ultimately, is sadness and bitterness. These trumpets and revelations seem to be introduced using the same literary approach as the seals. The first four of these seven trumpets seem to be meant to be taken as a unit. The first four of the seals are conquest, famine, war, and death. Okay, those are the four horsemen. And the first four of the trumpets, though, are earth, sea, fresh water, and heavens. And these are meant to show the breadth and the width of God's control over the affairs of mankind and creation. The last three seals, martyrdom, judgment, and rest, show the result of God's intervention on behalf of the faithful. Okay? The next three trumpets are going to show the same. And these will represent three woes which were given to the earth. which were announced by the angel flying in mid-heaven. Woe, 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 the angel cries. And it will represent God's specific answers on behalf of the prayers of the saints. Chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were told not to hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. That sounds horrible, doesn't it? And in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die and death flees from them. The appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads appeared to be crowns like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like the hair of women, and their teeth were like the teeth of lions. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots, of many horses rushing to battle. I don't know if you've ever been in a locust swarm, but it kind of does sound that way, doesn't it? They have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. They have as king over them the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollyon. The first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still coming after these things. As if the first woe wasn't bad enough. Okay. Well, you'll notice two angels are mentioned in this narrative. The first angel is the one that was given the key to the bottomless pit. Now, several have interpreted this angel to be Satan, since he's described elsewhere in Scripture as being an angel of God that had rebelled. Read Ezekiel 28. I've brought that forward before as a possible interpretation. The reasoning is that this angel in Revelation 9 was the one who released the horrible creatures of the abyss. So people make the conclusion that he's Satan. There's also the imagery of the falling star, which seems to correspond to Jesus' words to the 70 about how he saw Satan falling from heaven in Luke 10:18. But we need to remember here that God sent this angel to open the abyss. Okay? Well, if he's not Satan, then who would this ruler of those who come out of the abyss be but the second angel mentioned named Abaddon or Apollyon? These are the Hebrew and Greek forms of the same name, which is roughly translated destroyer. Okay? Stevenson in his book says this, as previously noted, the seal of God is a mark of identification that protects the faithful from divine judgment. The locust attack the unsealed, in other words, the inhabitants of the earth, and he tortures them for 5 months. Once again, the limitation of judgment occurs. Okay? Not only is the time frame limited to 5 months, but no one among those tormented dies from the judgment. The limitation of the activity of the trumpets to 1/3, the first four trumpets, and 5 months, which is the fifth trumpet, suggests that the function of judgment here is not solely punishment or vengeance, but that another factor is also at play. John's description of this locust plague is strongly reminiscent of the prophet Joel's description of an army of locusts invading the land to bring judgment on the disobedient. Job chapters 1 and 2. In both accounts, the locusts are associated with fire, and I've given you the references in your notes there. They appear like horses in battle. They have teeth like that of a lion. Their activity leads to the darkening of the sun. All these images are parallel in both Revelation and Joel. Now, although one must be cautious of reading too much of the Joel text into Revelation 8 due to significant differences, and there are, The overt similarities between the two locust plagues raises the question of whether the judgment by locust plague might serve the same function as the judgment by locust plague in Joel 1 and 2. In Joel, the plague of locusts functions to generate repentance. So Stevenson wonders, is this same plague in Revelation meant to do the same thing, to generate repentance? Stevenson's conclusion is that the first woe is meant as a warning to the inhabitants of the earth, not those who are sealed by God, but to the inhabitants of the earth who are unsealed, to see that the judgment of God will be swift, will be straightforward, will be catastrophic. There will come a time when, as in Joel's time, the patience of God will finally end and the horrific acts of those who persecute and mislead God's people will be dealt with by God Himself. Okay. I know I've been giving it to you like a fire hose this morning, but what if these things are true? If first and second century people are reading the Revelation and they believe that the message is for them, like, by the way, I think it says that it's for them, okay? So if they believe that and they're reading this, and they on their level can get a lot of this imagery because of their familiarity with this kind of language, and they're under persecution, how would this affect them? All right, let me say it this way. Go ahead.
Give them hope that it's only going to last a certain time.
All right, give them hope that it's only going to last a certain time. And what? That it will come to an end. There are limits to this. And that they can put their hope in God because He really is in control. He really is in control. It doesn't look like He's under control. He's promised that this is going to get worse before it gets better. But He's also demonstrating, using this illustrative language, that the great and mighty and sovereign God, from His perch in heaven, not only looks down on the earth, but can go between the two and keep things under control in the earth, regardless of how horrible it looks. You don't really have to worry.
I think, you know, a lot of people try to relate real Revelation to today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But God's in complete control, and I think that's the number one thing we as Christians have to realize and believe without doubt.
Right.
That He is still in control.
Right.
Even though we see it going on around us even today, things that go on that are evil.
Right.
And how bad they're getting. But it has nothing to do with Revelation.
Yeah. The truth of the matter is, it's never looked good. Because God, the enemy of God, has always been active and persecution has always been with us. I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, Paul said and Jesus said both that persecution was going to be a part of our lives. Because things are just not, that this world is not going to be straightened out because God loves us. I think that's a misnomer we need to correct right now. Doesn't mean that you can't feel the effects of God's love. It does not mean that you can't endure and have times of peace and times of plenty. It doesn't mean that you're not going to find a way to enjoy your life. But it does mean that you're going to intersect evil and you're going to intersect suffering. And when those times happen, first of all, Don't look up at God and say, "Where are you?" Because he really is close. Don't look up at God and say, "You're not treating me fairly." Because he is. He always has. But look up at God and say, "I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth." This is our privilege as children of God, regardless of the level of persecution or suffering or evil or pain that we might be surrounded with. God is always in control and sovereign. And the only people who have to fear anything are the unsealed, the ones who do not have that God's place in their lives. The great vision, although given to a minority church that is oppressed and persecuted by their world, tells the entire world that God will judge with righteous judgment. He has the power, he has the means, and will soon exercise the opportunity. The one who controls the seas, the skies, the earth, and the heaven will soon act. But for those who are the unsealed especially, there's still two other woes. Oh my goodness. That's where we'll begin next week. Thank you for your time.